You know, there's something about an artwork being pristine, you know, like being untouchable. They almost like stay the same over time, and there's a pristineness in this, you know, there's a value in that.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is Yusef Agbo Ola. Hi, Yusef.
Yes. Hi, Johann. How's it going? Great to be here.
Very good. Summer arrived.
Right.
Yusef, you are an architect and also an artist.
Yes.
So are you working still as an architect?
Yeah, for sure. For me, I guess I can just do a prerequisite to the talk and just say, for me, I think architecture and art is like, mentally for me, the lines are blurred, you know? For me, I'm not interested in skyscrapers. I'm not interested really in the traditional kind of tectonic of like architecture. For me, architecture is a way of thinking, and the way that you apply architectural thinking to different artistic kind of situations allows me to like express myself freely. So,
but the free, I think that's an important point, no? Because architecture usually serves. It has a commissioner, right. And the commissioner has a certain need. Then it's applied art.
For sure.
But then it's like it serves its certain purpose, and art is sort of free in its, I mean, you create art, which is sort of, has an influence by architecture, but it's free in a sense, it still needs the spectator, which I guess every art needs, but you create sort of pavilions, temples. So how did you get there? Did you first do a temple, or did you were commissioned to do a temple for example?
Scale is really important for me, you know, to do a large scale kind of like temple structure that I've been working on recently, that is commission based, you know, so that takes resources and things like this. But I would say, you know, to your other point, I feel like very much so, I agree that architecture is kind of a service based, you know, kind of profession or aspiration. But then at the same time, I feel like me, I still have clients, you know, like, and for me, they're more ancestral. Like, you know, I feel like my ancestors are also like my clients kind of living through me, and they are hard clients as well. Mm-hmm. Like I can feel like when I'm going off like of kind of like their direction, or going like kind of outside of my own heritage, you know, and they'll draw me back in really quick. So for me, I think, you know, in that way, I think my work architecturally, let's say, it's still serving kind of like who I am as a person in that way. But yeah, I feel like there is a freedom, you know, when it comes to creating art, you know, and I never want to be in a position where, you know, my title kind of limits what I can create and how I create it, you know. So for me, architecture and art, or artist and architect, it's a blur. Mm-hmm. For me.
And what came first? Mm-hmm. So you came into the art through architecture, or?
Yeah, I've always been, like, since a small kid, I wanted to be an architect, you know, but I wasn't great in math. You know, math was not my strong suit, you know? So I actually studied anthropology. I started looking at, like, sacred cultural, like, artifacts from China, from India, from Nigeria, from, like, all over the world. And I would just study those artifacts, and I was like, okay, like, but these are actually artworks. So I started to then from there learn about art and start to create, basically. And then after there, I finished kind of, you know, I started to express myself as an artist, learning the language of art. And then when I started to go back to architecture, I said, okay, there's no way I can not apply the freedom that I had from studying and creating artworks on an architectural scale, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right now you're in Berlin to work on a project at the Schering Stiftung. Maybe you can tell us about it, what you're planning to do there.
Yes, so that temple is, it's actually a collaboration with Tabitha Rezer. And we are actually making a Yemonja temple. Yemonja is a deity in Yoruba. She is the mother of all waters. So before having the commission, we actually went scuba diving with some scientists in Tanzania and in a freshwater lake, and also in seawater, to basically like look at microorganisms, look at different kind of sea creatures, and also understand like the cultural complexities and relationships and cosmologies about water in those areas. And yeah, after that research of scuba diving experience in the water, I then started to look at some of the samples that were taken, like the different kind of diatoms and different kind of microscopic organisms, and then created those microscopic kind of organisms into a large scale kind of shrine and temple for this deity. And so
the biological shape of the
microorganisms,
yeah, they inform the shape of the pavilion of the temple.
Exactly.
Okay.
On multiple different levels. From the top view, the shape of the temple is actually a drop of water.
Okay.
Like either a teardrop or a raindrop.
Yeah.
But then from the side, you have microorganisms.
The pattern.
Mm-hmm. And like on each kind of fabric, you also have multiple layers of like kind of symbolic motifs of like these microscopic organisms. So on each layer, depending on your viewpoint, you have like kind of different symbolism. And yeah, I like to work in this way because I feel like everything around us is so multi-layered.
Mm.
You know, it's like you see, for instance, this table, but this table is made up of so many different kind of components, so many molecules, so many layers of materials and things like this. And sometimes we don't see or sometimes we don't always experience those layers. So I like to kind of make them make these temples so people can experience like multi-sensory layers of existence.
Yeah, that's interesting that it's like an immersive experience. I came visiting you in the Folkwang Museum in Essen.
Amazing.
Where you also created a temple that was sort of a monument or like homage to some animal, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm glad we met there. That was amazing. You know, really, really great. That temple was it's a really special one because I split my time between London and the Amazon forest. So 6 months and 6 months, and there's a special frog in the forest called the poison dart frog. And again, going back to scale, it's like the size of your fingernail, but it's very, very, very venomous. But it's actually endangered and on the verge of going extinct. So for me, like I see this beautiful kind of frog that I don't necessarily see all of the time. You know, it's very hard, very rare to spot them. But I thought, you know, like, I mean, this frog is very beautiful, very amazing. You know, it serves so much kind of like very particular functions in its ecosystem, but it's endangered. So like I wanted to do like some type of homage of or some type of almost monument or memorial kind of in a way, like in an environmental awareness kind of stone or capsule, you know, so people could understand the disappearing kind of aspects of the species. So the same thing with the Yemanjá temple, I started to look at its different skin patterns, look at pregnant ones, also look at like how they reproduce, like look at the smaller kind of the cells of the...
Lots of different green tones as well, right?
Exactly.
The fabric, different fabric materials.
Completely, completely. So they normally are, they're beautiful kind of metallic, they have multiple colors, but when they are either scared or afraid or... they actually change color to these poisonous kind of very vibrant saturated hues. So I really wanted to play with color in a different way and have people experience this frog on a different scale.
But when you pick your sort of symbols or idols or, you know, the topics, that's happening free and independent, or are these topics sort of commissioned? Or both?
Oh, no, completely independent.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's more so the commission part is like, you know, we like the work that you've done in the past, so we understand kind of what you're working on. And, you know, how can we work together to realize something that, you know, maybe on a different scale outside of a commission you might not be able to realize. So I think working in the public realm, public art pieces is something that I'm really interested in and working on now, working on large scale kind of permanent pieces that allow people to engage with the environment in totally different ways.
You did projects at the Venice Biennale, you did, among others, the British Pavilion, you did a temple at the Palais de Tokyo, at the Folkwang, now Schering is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience of the audience in all these different places? Is there any difference?
For sure. I think it's, You know, one thing that's really funny about the museum is that sometimes, you know, working inside is it's not that it's problematic, you know, but I guess I will say it's a different experience, you know, than actually having these structures and temples outside. You know, I had a project at Tai Kung Art Center in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and that was the first temple that was actually installed outside in a public space. Mm-hmm. So the engagement was totally different. People were, you know, stopping. I mean, they have a culture anyway of these shrines and kind of altars all over Hong Kong. People put incense mm-hmm. and things like this. But I think, you know, having a structure like that, people were really engaged with it in a totally different way because it was outside of the museum, but still on the museum kind of grounds. So I just said that to say, you know, when I'm installing a temple indoors, I think visitors experience it in totally different ways and they're allowed to immerse themselves inside of the sound. A lot of times with smells and different fragrance that I'm working with. But I think outside, it's a really surprising kind of experience the way people see the sky differently when they're actually inside the temple, mm-hmm. where the sun can collaborate with the piece because it casts shadows that then can move throughout the kind of cityscape or natural environment as well. So I think, yeah, I try actually to stay away from thinking too much about kind of trying to control or curate the visitor's experience, but I like to view, you know, and I know everybody is coming into an experience with their own kind of energies of the day, you know. So for me, I think my job kind of stops at, you know, kind of paying respect to my ancestors and also like realizing the project, and then everybody else can kind of have their own experience with the project.
So you mm-hmm. it sounds like you prefer your mm-hmm. temples to be unguarded.
For sure.
Yeah. I think we were like sort of stopped mm-hmm. by the guard in the museum when we sort of approached the temple too intensively and touched it and so on.
For sure.
Of course, for them it's difficult to draw the line between mm-hmm. this artwork and the other artworks. No, again, yeah. the conflict of architecture and art maybe.
But on that note, let me add, Johan, add to this. Because this is great. I think, you know, there's something about an artwork being pristine, you know, like being untouchable. It has to almost like stay the same over time. And there's a pristineness in this, you know, there's a value in that. But for me, I think, I mean, architecturally as well. But for me, I'm very much so interested in ideas of entropy and decay and transformation. So, for instance, half of my time that I'm spending in the Amazon, I want to have a sculpture park at one point, like in the forest. And these temples, they will just be consumed by the natural environment.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're meant to be like kind of armatures in a way where plants, you know, snakes can live inside, birds can poop on it. But in the bird poop, there's like seeds. So then like plants grow on these fabrics. They completely transform over time, you know. So I think this aspect for me kind of separates me from the fact of like, you know, everything. Of course, I make other pieces that are different, you know?
Yeah.
But some element, the temples for me are meant to transform, like architectural death is like extremely like, or the process of death becoming life is extremely kind of important for the works, you know?
So, and art and spirituality, how, maybe we can get back to your first temple. What is it informed by? How did you come to create these sculptures, which are, they need the spectator, they need like the visitor to walk mm-hmm. in. But where did it come from to do these sort of also interactive mm-hmm. sculptures? What is it rooted in?
Okay, so here is a top secret kind of information. So I guess like my dad he's a priest as well. And I think growing up, I had like a really crazy experience that I can remember as a child. You know, I was going to theology school with my dad. He was doing his master's in theology. And I remember sitting in the law library with like 20 books, like wide open, literally different languages, different cultures, some from China, some from Israel, some from, you know, some from Africa, some from all over South America. And when I think back, I didn't really know what I was looking at, But when I look back, it was actually like temples from like all of these different cultures, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was super inspired by that unknowingly, you know, as a child. But when I look back at that experience, I just remember how kind of enthused and interested I was, mm-hmm. not necessarily in the religion, but just in kind of these structures that were sacred kind of spaces.
Interesting, yeah, because obviously the human seemed to have a desire, mm-hmm. if it's the synagogue or the moshe or the church, to build sort of an architectural structure which allows contemplation and like a space to pray and to come to a certain... That's another thing noticeable, like in your project in the Palais de Tokyo, people sort of calm down in your installations, huh?
Yeah, in that space, there was actually a performance that was there as well. And it was a soil space, no soil temple. So there was a bed, like two temples. Sometimes you have an outer structure of a temple, and then you have like a synagogue or a kind of tabernacle or altar in the middle of it. So symbolically, we made a small structure inside of a large structure. And then in the middle of that structure, it was full of soil. So people actually were, you know, there was a kind of a ceremony for soil bathing. So we buried people, in about six people at a time, in soil, and they stayed for a certain amount of time while also listening to the sound installation. So I think that, I think that aspect of just, you know, being able to connect with soil in a different way was great for us to have people experience it.
And tell me again, your father, so he a Christian preacher?
Yes, he's Christian, but no sect, like non-denominational. You know, and it's really tricky because I feel like all of my lineage are almost like rebels in a way, mm-hmm. like we switch religions, you know. Mm-hmm. So my great-great-grandfather, he was like kind of like traditional, like tribal, or not tribal, but in a sense the indigenous religion of like Ifa. And then from Ifa, my
Where was he from?
Nigeria. My father is Nigerian.
But yes. He was American, your second American, no?
Yes, my father moved from Nigeria to the U.S.
Okay, so I was born in Nigeria. He was not born in the U.S.
Yeah, he was born in Nigeria. Okay. Mm-hmm. He was born in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, the lineage keeps changing. So then it goes to Christian, then it goes to Muslim. Now my dad is Christian, and now me, I have my own kind of ideology, kind of not connected to any of those things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was a priest, and I did grow up in the church, in the Christian church. And yeah, I was always fascinated, you know, by the scriptures, by different things and different kind of beliefs. And then at the same time, I was also a rebel, you know, always questioning him, you know, like, but how does this work, and how does that work? So me, I think I'm really interested in many different kind of belief systems around the world, and they always kind of inspire me in totally different ways.
And in the perception of the viewer, how relevant is it? What was your initial motivation to build the temple, like the frog, mm-hmm. in Folkwang Museum? Mm-hmm. Is it like how relevant is this information to mm-hmm. I often say about art that it you can experience it on its own, and if you know more, you see more, but it's not necessarily always important to have so much background information for the pure experience.
For sure. For the creator, for me, it's important. But for the viewer, it's not important. You know, in the sense that I feel like I call the temples living architectural entities in a way. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they have a presence kind of on their own. That's why when I mentioned before, I kind of take myself away from that kind of user experience in a way, because people will come with their own kind of ideologies, their own understanding of it. But for me, having those layers of a contextual kind of framework always kind of, you know, it just makes me more kind of creative. It makes me more kind of enthused and like engaged with what I'm working on. I like the layers of symbolism. Mm-hmm. That's important.
So we talked about the temple you are building right now for Schering Stiftung and about the one you did at Folkwang. Maybe we can explore, right now there's a Lagos Biennial where you take part in. What did you do there?
So that one is it's a different kind of tectonic, you know. It wasn't a temple that people can actually walk inside of. It was more like an altarpiece, kind of like a, a large scale altarpiece inspired by just looking at like banana seeds, mm-hmm. like inside, like under electron microscope, going like maybe two million times what the eye can see, like to like, yeah, basically like these internal kind of infinitesimal architectures. And from there, I wanted to like scale those up. The banana and banana leaves has a, you know, it's a really, it has so many kind of functionalities in Nigeria. Bananas can be used for so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was really like a cultural statement. And it's my first time actually showing in Nigeria where all of my family is from. So maybe you don't understand this.
So what are bananas used for? It's like a resource, yeah?
Yeah, for sure. A resource, but also medicine, food. There's so many different ways that you can cook it. But also for me, I love the food actually gets better the more it decays.
Mm-hmm.
So when you want to fry plantain, you know, you don't fry when the banana is yellow. You fry when it's like pitch black, mm-hmm. really soggy, because that's when it's the sweetest, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to mention just then was like, it was the first time that my Nigerian side of my family like really knew I wasn't crazy, you know?
Yeah. Being in a professional context,
for sure.
Whose tickets are sold.
For sure. Exactly. They're like, okay, this is what you do in the world, you know? So they were able to experience it,
yeah.
you know, firsthand. So that was really special to inspire my...
So your father, you think he wanted you to follow his preacher career?
That's a great question. I don't know deep down what he really wanted, but he never proposed it in that way.
So how did you... Was there art around your family? How did you find your way into architecture and then art? Because you're from where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia. Virginia, actually in a really small town called Chuckatuck, you know? Mm-hmm. It was an old Indian kind of village. You know, one brother's name was Chuck, one was Tuck. And so they combined basically and made this Indian village, you mm-hmm. know? So the Nelson River Indians, to be exact. But basically, yeah, there was nothing around that. I kind of grew up in nature, you know, like, well, who knows how we define nature? That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
But it's like I grew up around trees and there's rivers, there's lake. We were playing around.
You mean nature, like not touched by humans, sort of?
But yeah, that's a whole different, because for sure.
Now, that's what you're referring to, right?
Right.
That nature is not really...
Exactly. Yeah,
but
exactly.
The Amazonas is pretty much nature, no?
For sure.
Still,
I think, yeah, certain parts of it, you know? I mean, now, yeah, it's parts that are completely untouched for sure, you know? But then you also have places that look like they're untouched, but there's still, you know, different tribes living there, you know, that is, again, touched by humans.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, it depends on what we mean by that part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
so, and then... So you spend a lot of time outside in the forest and so on?
For sure.
And from there you moved, like you finished high school, and then how did art come up as a possibility?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I was asked this recently and I really don't know, like as far as like conceptually, like when the like art came into like my idea. I think for me the most important thing was like I felt like I had something to say. You know, and I didn't really know exactly how to communicate it, you know, because I didn't grow up going to we went to museums, science museum, natural history museum, mm-hmm. you know, but we didn't grow up in like gallery culture. I didn't grow up like going to like contemporary kind of art shows or anything
yeah.
like this. The only thing I really had was we had a huge library of books
mm-hmm.
and I just really liked the artifacts and different things in the books. But conceptualizing that as like these are like artworks. And this is like art is really it wasn't really encouraged or like not something I really thought about as a child. So I think to answer your question is I, as a kid, I really didn't like growing up in such a peaceful, serene environment like that. Now I look back and I'm grateful for it. But every summer, my parents would send us to New York
mm-hmm.
to go and stay with our cousins. So every summer we would leave, and I thought New York was heaven, you know,
yeah.
in the sense of so many people around.
Like in the city in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
Yeah.
We were in Brooklyn, actually, but in Manhattan
all over.
So I think there, like, that is maybe when I first probably experienced my first gallery kind of mm-hmm. like vibe, you know, things like this. And I would always be the one to then go back when school would start, you know, as the guy that always goes to New York every summer, kind of with this information this art is doing this, like this creative person doing da-da-da-da. So I think maybe, I've never really said this before, maybe, I could be wrong, maybe this is kind of glimpses of kind of contemporary art and where it came from, besides like kind of looking at those sacred spiritual artifacts when I was younger.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, by all negative elements from social media and in the internet, that's something also which has a great benefit is to, you know, when you like in a in a countryside or small town or whatever, you can at least connect and find content which speaks to you and is very niche, which before you could probably only find in the big city anywhere, but only in big cities. So how important was like internet, social media for sort of sharing information, providing information for you, which triggered your interest?
Yeah, for sure. But me, I'm 33 years old, you know? So back when I was a kid, basically, we didn't have internet really until I was like 11, 12, and with the AOL kind of did phone. I don't really remember growing up with the internet until I was like a teenager. So I still had both sides, but then at that point, you know, it was like I was a teenager, but then I just got a car. So then it was like, okay, if I want to go meet my friends, I was out and about. But then going into college, I think social media maybe and just using the internet more, especially, you know, researching and just, you know, taking in the internet, I guess, if you will, like for sure, you know, so much kind of inspiration just kicked in, like as usual.
And then from anthropology, you came to architecture, to art. So how many temples have you built by now?
To date, eight.
Eight, okay.
Eight.
Mm-hmm. And you would consider the altar piece from Lagos a temple as well?
No, it's an altar.
Okay.
So I've been working in different kind of series now, you know, and I think I used to actually make, my first medium was ceramics. So I used to make big, large-scale ceramics, but then, like, basically, if I didn't get a commission, you know, it would cost a lot to actually ship them.
Yeah.
So somehow, like, working with the textiles and fabrics allowed me to work big, but I still have light shipping costs, you know? But for me, I work in series, and the altars are kind of like a series of smaller kind of sacred kind of objects, and the temples are another series of different works that are kind of a lot bigger, you know, more experiential in that way.
And in the British Pavilion, what did you do there?
It was a temple called Maluku Six Bone Temple. And it was a temple that actually, it took like an ecosystem of endangered species, used it as inspiration to make two, like basically like a 4x8 meter butterfly from the side view. But if you went underneath the butterfly wings, you would see like the different kind of microorganisms that live on the wings, as well as like these endangered species that feed off of them as well. So that had a temple kind of element, and then that also had an altar on the wall, which was like a single piece where people could do like a lavender offering like to the piece. It was a smaller textile work on the wall as well.
Interesting. So, and your altars or temples, they're always free of any, I mean, they carry sort of religious references in them, which is also interesting that they have so many elements in common, but there's never a clear reference to any world religion, I would say.
Right. Not at all. I think that's a kind of a good point, because like that's why I said my client is kind of my ancestors and my own heritage, because on my mom's side, I have Cherokee Native American and then African American as well. And then on my dad's side, that's just Nigerian, you know? So basically, like looking at the Yoruba culture or like Francis Cherokee, looking at different teepee structures or different ways they used to actually stretch kind of animal skins as well, or the different motifs that come on those. I feel like that stuff was just coming out of me, coming out of me in the creative process. And then once I started to go back and kind of do, you know, just look at my culture, look at the different history, I see the correlations and the connections. So it's not connected directly to like a Yoruba shrine or to a specific kind of deity in Native American culture. It's kind of just sacred, like in its own way. For me, the sacred is the transformation, it's the decay, the metamorphosis that I want to happen, you know, on these temples over time. Like, I would love to leave a temple in the forest for 5 years, photograph it each year, and see like the decay kind of process and the whole forest kind of take it over, or in the desert, you know, or somewhere like this where the sun can, you know, change the color of the fabrics over time. You know, it turns into something completely else, or shading.
But don't you have them also installed in the rainforest? Don't you have a...
For sure.
Yeah.
I have altars installed in the rainforest now in like different places.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner has 11 hectares of land in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, yeah, I have some installed kind of in the forest area. But also like we're constantly like trying to find the best places to basically build out the temples. So some are getting shipped back from different museums. Some are in the process of...
But I mean, they need the audience, no? They need mm-hmm. to be visited and lived through, no? So is this really a destination to come visit?
For sure. I mean, there's two kind of aspects for that. One aspect is, like, I've been trying to push hard for different museums that I'm showing in to actually co-commission or collaborate with botanical gardens in the actual city
mm-hmm.
as well to like install a piece. Like, I think that's kind of one direction. But on the other direction, I think the people that are living in Cayenne, it's actually French Guyana where I'm living on the border of Brazil, the on top of Brazil. But I think people there have a different kind of ideology about the forest.
Mm-hmm.
The forest is not kind of this like
idealized thing.
Idealized kind of thing. It's a dangerous thing. You know, people get bit by snakes.
And it's also, it's a source of resource, no?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. For mining and all types of things. So I think actually doing stuff there is actually great because you can bring people into the forest and have them like on maybe on a trail to experience something in a totally different way rather than saying, okay, just take a pilgrimage in the forest without, you know, that purpose for them mm-hmm. in a sense, because culturally, it's sometimes, you know, looked at as a dangerous place.
It's always a question of perspective, no?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. 100%. 100%. But it is dangerous, though.
On top, yeah.
I think the Amazon, the cool thing about it is it's not what you see that's actually that dangerous. It's like what you don't see. So if like you go swimming in the river and like, you know, a leech or something gets under your skin or something, the small, tiny things is more dangerous than actually a snake bite, because a snake is going to leave you before it can hear you coming ages away, you know, or a jaguar. I mean, it wants to be by itself, you know, anyway, but it's the little insects that I love, you know, but they are very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Is the frog you did the altar for dangerous too? The temple for?
For sure. It's very dangerous.
Oh, very dangerous.
It's a poison dart frog. It's the mm-hmm. most poisonous frog in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only the size of a fingernail.
You know? Okay.
So there's other larger species, but the poison dart frog species I was looking at is the size of a fingernail, but I mean, it can paralyze. It has enough venom to paralyze, I don't know.
But it's in danger.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, so it's also like an homage to creatures in general. If bad, so to speak, or good, it's a homage to nature. I mean, if it's so poisoned still, how come you picked this animal?
Yeah, I have a connection to the frog, for one. I mean, the frog is kind of like my totem, but also I like the symbolism in like something very small holding enough kind of venom and poison to kill like 10, 15 people through just one touch, you know?
Wow.
It's tiny, you know? So for me, there is a symbolism there that is really quite interesting. And actually, if you just see the frog, it's actually extremely gorgeous. You know, the skin is constantly pulsating and it changes its colors based on its emotional kind of state and how it feels. So for me, this reactivity, mm-hmm, if that's mm-hmm. a word, like how reactive it is to the environment, its emotions and how it feels and how it displays itself is also kind of how I want the temples to operate in collaboration with the natural kind of energy systems, whether that be rain, light, wind, dust, sun, and also humans and other non-humans. So for me, for those reasons, like the frog is very kind of interesting. And I think symbolically, the fact that it's endangered based on, like you say, resource in the forest or even just different kind of poisons that get in his skin based on like the different kind of contaminations that's in the river system. Like all of those things make it even more vital for me to kind of focus on that frog for my own sake and love for the frog, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And tell me, besides the temple and the altar pieces, mm-hmm. how else would you describe mm-hmm. your practice?
For sure. I think there is I'm working on sound quite a bit as well. So there's some elements of sound. I've worked on different kind of, for me, the main underarching kind of thing in all of my works has to do with environmental awareness and entropy transformation decay, you know? And so I've worked on kind of different kind of elements of those same kind of, those same interests. Like, for instance, I worked on a living kind of a footwear line that is, it's not really a line. They're like artifacts, you know, but mm-hmm. they're living kind of shoes as artworks.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a commercial kind of object. You know, you could say like, you know, it's a commercial object as a shoe, but the actual prototype is an artwork that constantly changes and reacts. And
because it's also with found natural material, right?
Exactly, yeah. 100%.
It's more like a Karl Marx mm-hmm. sort of shoe.
Exactly,
like
exactly.
A sample of a mm-hmm. produced product or so, no?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a, yeah, it's, it has its, it draws people in, I guess, to the conceptual kind of aspect of it because it's a regular object, same as Duchamp's kind mm-hmm. of urinal, mm-hmm. you know, in a way.
Maybe more for our generation, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
but it's maybe important to mention it's a unique object, yeah.
One time.
In the shape of a shoe.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's made out of like living materials in that way, like materials that are alive. And and it has kind of its own kind of function and its own kind of collaborative responses to the environment as well. You know, it's very reactive, but it's one, you know, so that's one element I'm working on sound, but also like, ceramics is something that, and recently I've been doing some totems as well. So wood carving. So those will be in the show coming up as well. So I'm really excited about that because it brings kind of like another kind of sacred terminology, but typology into
yeah.
the work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You have altars, totems, temples, shrines as well, like all.
That's also interesting as elements in architecture and design, no? When you think of Sotsa's totems.
Mm.
You know, these like stacks of ceramic. And tell me, it's interesting, you have been exhibited quite a lot in Europe and also in Germany. You have an explanation for that?
I don't know. I need help, Johan. Because actually, like, it's weird. Like, my sister also, I feel like I haven't got much love from the U.S.
Exactly, even though you're from there, no?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like, my sister also, I have a nephew now. He's 4. You know, my grandmother is 89 now. So me, I don't travel as much to the U.S., you know, and I feel like the U.S. hasn't given me love. I will say, I don't know if I should, you know, but anyway, San Francisco, MoMA,
yeah,
they have given me, some support. They've given me the most support I've had in the U.S., but mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know.
But no show or no
show.
Interesting.
No
yeah. Yet.
So that's something. And then also, Asia has given me quite a bit.
Yeah, you mentioned Hong Kong. Yeah,
yeah, Hong Kong has given me some support. But Europe is maybe because that's kind of where the network is as a young man going, you know, establishing kind of your network. I mean,
mm-hmm. Now, I mean, at the same time, it's also so interesting how these different countries have different relationships to religion and spirituality. You know, in America, you have these pastors with like private jets, you know,
sure.
We and their own television channel and so on. We don't have that here. And also the church or the religion doesn't really play a big role in the political competition.
Mm-mm.
So interesting. Interesting, yeah. But you also don't have an explanation why the US is not...
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Because also the British Pavilion, that I mean, all these borders or identification, how did that happen?
For sure. I think that, I mean, I think that's kind of, the show was called Dancing Under the Moon, you know? And I think, I mean, for instance, there were different people from different places some people were born in Britain, but all of us were kind of from different places.
Mm-hmm. So, but the commissioner was British probably, no?
Yes, I mean, there was, yeah, the commissioner was British, I mean, the British Council, you know, so yeah, they are British, but the curators were all from like different places.
It was multiple curators.
Yeah, multiple mm-hmm. curators. So, I mean, they worked as one unit, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but yeah, from different places. So actually it was like a cross-cultural kind of like understanding of what it means to, I guess, work in Britain and express like where you're from within the context of Britain. Between art, architecture, and design.
And going back to Germany, was there ever something here which crossed your mind or attention where you think, okay, this is something that deserves a shrine or a temple?
Mm. The Koenig Gallery. That,
I imagine. That, you only can be spoken only 100 years after death, you know. It's like
that big space downstairs is amazing. It's a great...
No, but I thought like you went to Essen, you know, like the coal mining or the...
Right.
The rare, yeah, we have problem here actually in this neighborhood with pigeons.
I would love to. I haven't explored Germany properly, you know, even in Essen, like in Stollen, like even here, I'm back and forth. I haven't really kind of experienced, but I will say there's a presence here that I really like. Scale-wise, things are...
Spread out.
Yeah, spread out.
Yeah, yeah.
There's open, big spaces. Like, you know, I really... Any ceiling lower than like, I don't know, 2.5, 2.8, I feel claustrophobic. You know,
mm-hmm.
I like the 4 meter kind of ceiling, kind of, you know, and yeah. So for me, I feel there's a presence there for me in that way. You know?
Yeah.
And it seems like it's just normal to have a 4 meter kind of ceiling, kind of open, kind of place.
Yeah. Then let's find some topic and build a temple here with 15 meter ceiling height.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first thing I asked your colleague, like how tall is this room, you know? And so yeah, no, amazing, but it's really nice.
Yeah, we had, for example, a pretty phenomenal story last summer. You know, we have these there was a lion, like a tiger or a lion. They were sure that the tiger or lion, I can't remember what element, animal they thought to identify, got free and was running around. But there was no...
In Germany?
Here in Berlin, yeah. Berlin. But there was no source of it, so no one was missing a tiger or a lion. I don't know, I can't remember. and then they were assuming that, you know, immediately all these clichés came up that it's probably from some clan, you know, from some gangster mm-hmm. clan, that they have tigers for entertainment, and one got... So all this weird speculation came up, and then in the end it turned out there was
no tiger. Nothing.
There was nothing. Like, it was just like the news, the period where there are no news in the summer. Wow. So then
crazy. Yeah,
yeah, but that sounds like a plan.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to be in Berlin. You know, it's really a nice place, and it's warm. You know, I couldn't imagine like I wasn't expecting it to be so warm in April, but it's great. You know, I really enjoy it.
Cool, Josef. Thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with me. And I'm very much looking forward to the Tempel at Schering Stiftung opening on April 24th. Thanks, Josef.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.